what I want to hear first of all is if you can just kind of give people briefly the background of how you wound up working at that first animal shelter where mm-hmm. you worked, what kind of got you there?
Well, I mean, honestly, it was just me working some ridiculous dead-end jobs. I was a musician, and as musicians, we basically try to find anything that doesn't occupy brain bandwidth during the day so that you could just, you know, be ready to create at night. And I was just sick of working true dead-end jobs. And when I saw the ad in the paper for an animal welfare associate, I thought, okay, well, I'd rather work for animals and just, you know, clean cages and do whatever. And so I did it, and I obviously didn't expect what happened next, you know.
Well, I'm curious, when you're writing about your time at the shelter, it was clear that you were going to be drawn to the cat side more than the dog side. And I'm wondering, or that's what evolved over time. I'm wondering if you can kind of describe what it was about the cats that kind of pulled you in that direction.
Yeah, honestly, they pulled me. Like, I wasn't a cat person. I wasn't that kid who, you know, I'm 6 years old and the cats are speaking to me and, you know, I have to follow that path or whatever. I grew up with a dog. I love dogs. And I actually, when I imagined myself working at an animal shelter, it was with dogs. And within a couple of weeks of working at the shelter, literally I'd be sitting in a room full of cats and they'd all come to me. And I suddenly knew what to do with them. It never would have happened if it was just one-on-one with a cat. But when there's 20 of them, and all, there's something about that volume that made sense to me.
So you said they came to you, and you suddenly knew what to do. How did you know? Was it just something kind of inside
it
you?
Was.
That sounds a little corny. But is that what was going on?
You know what? I mean, let's be corny. I mean, I actually felt physically what their body language was saying. I actually felt it. It wasn't something I could explain, and there was just no way of knowing, you know, as they would walk across a room, I would know what they wanted and what they weren't getting and what made them anxious. And the rest of it becomes kind of easy, you know, to try to find solutions because you're in to begin with.
There was a night where you were working late at the shelter. I think you had a presentation or something you had to do the next day, and there was a really bad storm.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good example of kind of the relationship that you're describing. Tell us a little bit about that night and kind of how you and the cats were coexisting and working together that night.
Yeah. I mean, I was working on a presentation, and because I was just so completely ADD, you know, I was putting together PowerPoint, which is a nightmare, and I could only do it at like 2 o'clock in the morning when there was nobody else in the shelter, and we were in the middle of a drought, and no longer. Like, all hell broke loose. I mean, it was the most incredible storm, and it was an old shelter, and the place was just rattling, and water coming in through the ceiling, and everything. And my office backed up to what was called cat receiving. So any stray cats, any mama cats that came in, transfers from other shelters, were all in this one room. And they were absolutely screaming, like every cat in there. And I knew I would never get work done. And I was working on this new theory based on a friend of mine who had written a book, The Natural Cat. And it was called The Cat I Love You, the slow blink thing that now on my show seems like everybody knows the blink. And I went in and experimented with 45 cats at the same time. And it wasn't easy or fun, but it worked. And within a couple of hours, I had a room full of quiet cats, and a defining moment in your life where you realize that if I can do this, the amount of good that you can do in a shelter system is ginormous. And that's what led me to keep working.
Because it may seem obvious to say it, but cats who are living in a shelter are incredibly stressed.
Incredibly stressed. And you don't have time. You come in there, you have 72 hours to prove yourself as adoptable. And if not, you know, you get euthanized. And it's that dire that quickly. And there's that added bit of pressure that in my shelter situation, I was the one also, we were all killing animals. That was our job, was to love them on one hand, care for them, make them adoptable, and kill them. It was awful. And if my talent would save one of these cats, I was all over it. And talk about necessity being the mother of invention. I mean, I was absolutely driven to make small changes to make these guys adoptable, just to release that stress and anxiety.
So tell us about Benny.
Yeah, Benny was one of the cats that came through the shelter. He was dropped off unceremoniously at our front door with a shattered pelvis. He had been hit by a car the day before. The woman who dropped him off referred to him as unbondable.
Unbondable.
Unbondable. She said that she couldn't be friends with him. She had him for a year, and he just was too distant, too aloof, and unbondable. And at that point in my life, I could relate. I was pretty unbondable myself, and that started a journey between the two of us that went on for about 14 years, and that's what the book Cat Daddy's about.
So what was going on in your life at the time that Benny entered your life? You said you were unbondable.
Unbondable. Well, I mean, it's weird because having written the book now, my issues with drug and alcohol addiction have been pretty well documented, but that was it. I mean, I was living a very self-centered life. And when you say self-centered, it is through addiction you are practiced in the art of numb, of detaching. And that was where I was. But when you start to realize that you have a mission involving animals, they insist that you approach them on a raw, basic level. So that was my challenge. And Benny was a pretty challenging cat.
So the person who dropped Benny off said he's unbondable. I can't get along with him. Is that true? I mean, are there some cats that are unbondable?
No,
I mean,
there's no being on Earth that's unbondable, I don't think. I think that every species to one degree or another is social. It's just putting forth the effort to meet them on their side of the fence. And that is the story of humans and cats, is that humans are a bit lazy when it comes to companion animals because we love dogs so much, and dogs will more than gladly come to our end of the fence, and cats don't. So you have to meet them, and that's my job, is to make that meeting enjoyable, worthwhile, like to provoke that fascination that I had before.
People know that you're the host of My Cat from Hell on Animal Planet. And that's what we see in the show, are situations where you're trying to help the people and the cat sort of meet each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I'm wondering is, it seems to me the episodes that I've seen that we have a pretty good track record of not doing very well meeting the cats where they need to be. That it tends to be about us more than the cats.
Of course, of course. I mean, talk about hubris, right? Is that it's all about us. It's the cat hates me. That concept of the cat hates me in itself is so ludicrous. But again, that is my job. You know, my whole approach, I call it Cat Mojo, that if you understand the basic motivations of what it is to be a cat, and if I can translate that feeling that I was talking about, that I can feel the electricity going through these guys' body, if I can give that to you, which I know I can, then going to their side of the fence is not as big a struggle as you think it is. You're doing it because you want to enrich that bond, because you love them, and as beings that you love, you will do for them, you know, and so far, that approach has been pretty successful.
I realize for every cat, it's quite individual. If you can sort of characterize this whole, what tend to be kind of the set of cats' motivations? Because they're not, as you say, I'm mad at my human. Or
right,
there was
right.
One family where the cat was marking and urinating around the house, and they said the cat's rebelling.
Yeah.
You said, no, the cat's not rebelling.
Or they call it revenge pee.
Yes.
Revenge pee. Or there was actually spiteful puking. There was like all kinds of like that it somehow has something to do with you. If the cat throws up on your bed, it's all about you, you know, as opposed to perhaps a hairball or perhaps some kind of like stomach issue. And it really does take a lot for me to get people to step away from the cat, you know, and to realize that whatever's going on in your life, the cat is the least of your issues. You know what I mean? If you've got these kind of anxieties yourself, then you got to start looking at your own life. The amazing thing about cats is because they are a little bit other, because they're a little bit removed, more than a little bit, from the human experience, they are prime for projection. That we will take the worst of our days and put it on the cat. We wouldn't do that to the dog, because the dog is telling us what they want in human terms. Cat, not so much.
I'm thinking back to an episode of My Cat from Hell where I think it was a couple and they had at least one cat and the cat was urinating around the house. And you asked them, how often do you clean the litter pan? And they said, I think once a month. Mm-hmm. Almost fell out of my chair.
I know.
Once a month? No wonder the cat's going other places in the house and you don't have a clean place for it to go.
And then he was so proud of himself because I came back there and it was once every couple weeks. Yes. And he's like, but the cat's still peeing in the sink. I mean, this is a guy with a college degree. You know what I mean? When it comes down to that much of a remove from common sense, it astounds me sometimes. But again, my prime directive, which is keeping cats in homes, overrides sometimes that eye-rolling kind of, oh, really? Approach to humans, you know.
So not everybody who has a cat but maybe having issues between themselves and the cat can have you come to their house. Everybody can read the book, but they can't all necessarily have you come visit. Are there some kind of basic things or basic places where people can start to try to improve things in a house where something is not right for the cat and they're...
Well, that's the concept of Cat Mojo, is if you just understand the basics, and the basic is ownership. Cats are about territory. If they don't own that territory, they don't feel like they own that territory, or they feel like it's threatened, bad things are going to happen. And that's where so much of the litter box problems come from. So much of the aggression problems that I see, they come from territorial insecurity. So, you know, the best thing that you can do, and again, I joke about it, step away from the cat, you know, become a detective. Remove the emotionality. Start taking notes. Because the people who come to me, they say, oh, this is random behavior. You know, well, what happens is if you mark down that behavior for a week to 2 weeks, it's not random. You'll figure it out.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the end of Benny's life.
Yeah.
I know for a lot of people who live with cats, that's a hard time because they don't know when the time is upon them.
Right. And Benny taught me more about dying than any animal that I've spent time with, and believe me, I've spent time with a lot of animals. And the problem was that because he was dying of something that we couldn't figure out, he had really horrific asthma, and because of that asthma, we couldn't sedate him to image what was going on. I knew there was something to do with his breathing, but it was more on the other end. It was more in the sinus area. But because I couldn't define it, and I'm the fixer, I fix things, and I was unable to fix it, to approach it, to define it, it was driving me out of my mind. And it made me sit back and evaluate my approach, and the approach of the medical community in general, where there came a point where this poor boy, every time I touched him, I was putting pills and drops and, you know, all kinds of creams. And there's a fine line. And for animal guardians to make that leap from being the fixer to a hospice care worker is one of the hardest things. And you know what? It works for humans as well. But, you know, you have to put yourself aside. You made a deal when you took this animal into your life to be their guardian, to be the one who will lead them successfully through this life. And part of that is leading them successfully towards the end of this life. And it was incredibly painful. And the only reason I started writing the book in the first place was because I couldn't deal with the pain while he was dying. To sit back and just be with him, just to be a witness and keep him comfortable. And writing is the only thing I've ever known. I had to process complex emotions, and so I started writing it. And I feel honored now to have written it. I mean, even though literally the hardest thing I've ever done, because the feedback, the support, a sense of community amongst animal people who have lost is so great. I mean, it's a kind of grief that is pretty overwhelming.
Those are deep relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there, and I think that there's another thing. I think there's a level of guilt. I think that for much of us, the feeling is so pure and so deep because there's no language. There's no, I should have said, or why did he say, or why did she say, or resentments. There's nothing. So we grieve animals on a completely different level than we grieve humans. And I think sometimes we feel guilty for that because you can lose an animal. And like right now, I think about Benny 3 years, you know, and I can still summon that pain. Whereas with humans, you can walk through it more successfully, I think. So it's, I like the fact that I've helped create a community around loss, because by processing that, again, I have a prime directive here, and that is to get cats out of shelters, to get dogs out of shelters. The faster you process those emotions, the more completely you process them, the more you can bring others into your life.
You said Benny taught you about life and also about death and moving on. What are some of the other things that Benny taught you about life? How did he impact your life?
Well, he surely taught me about patience. His approach to my behavior work was to basically thumb his nose at me, which he did with great regularity his entire life. So I would bring home these complex behavioral approaches, and he would just be like, yeah, try again. You know, he was an incredibly challenging cat on a physical, behavioral, spiritual level, and he never eased up on me. So on a good day, he was my best teacher, and on a bad day, he was just the biggest pain in the neck ever.
Are there cats who aren't challenging to us in some way?
Sure.
There are?
Well, you haven't met him yet? Well, you know, I call them dog cats. And dog cats are the ones that follow you from room to room. Mm-hmm. You go out on a walk. They're walking around the block with you. They fetch bottle caps. They talk to you on a dog level. And on a dog level, we get it. We understand it. We have evolved dogs to behave certain ways. So when cats behave that way, we're like, oh, I get it. I get what you're trying to say to me. It's the challenge for humans is to release our humanity, release our egos, and accept that in order to be loved and love a species like cat, you have to surrender, and they demand it. And that's probably why I love being with them so much.
Jackson Galaxy is the author of Cat Daddy, What the World's Most Incorrigible Cat Taught Me About Life, Love, and Coming Clean. Jackson, thanks so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.